hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is Arneson versus Arneson. For the appellant is Rita Allen, an attorney from Sioux Falls, and for the appellee, Ms. Lee Bird, an attorney also from Sioux Falls. Ms. Allen, you may proceed.
Good morning, counsel. My name is Rita Allen. I'm an attorney in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I represent Travis Arneson on appeal. Rhonda Lockwood represented Travis Arneson at the trial level, and she and I represent Travis Arneson, the plaintiff and appellant, on appeal. In a determination of child custody, trial court has broad discretion. However, there are things that a trial court cannot and must not do. It cannot discriminate on the basis of disability. It cannot ignore the repeal of the tender years doctrine by the legislature. And it must recognize established principles of custody, and its findings must have support in the record. The appellant and plaintiff are contending that the trial court in this matter violated all of those requirements, and for that reason, the case must be reversed and remanded to the trial court. First of all, on the issue of whether or not the trial court can discriminate on the basis of disability, although the issue of the Americans with Disabilities Act was relied on in two sets of objections before the trial court, whether or not the ADA applies, there's case law preceding the ADA. The California case, the Carney case, simply recognizes that you cannot discriminate on the basis of disability. And to discriminate on the basis of disability basically is to make stereotypical assumptions and rely on unfounded fears, which is exactly what happened here. Instead of looking at the individual facts of the case, there were assumptions, there were presumptions made that simply do not have a basis in the record. A fear that he would not be able to take care of emergencies or could not move fast enough. In fact,
did the court make findings of fact which you have a problem with that you can point to as discriminatory?
What the court did is in his findings, both at the trial on the record, but in the findings, said that he placed great reliance on the observations and conclusions reached by the home study expert in her testimony and report, which is in evidence, I believe, exhibit number 3. So he incorporated the conclusions, incorporated the observations, and incorporated basically what the home study report preparer had come to. And she's very clear in her testimony that the physical disability is the reason that she came down on this issue of custody. In fact, she's asked, is it because of the wheelchair? And she says, well, it's not just the wheelchair, it's her concern about being able to respond in a crisis situation, which ignores certain facts in this case, very relevant facts. For 5 months, when this child was a baby, Travis Arneson took care of this baby alone from 11 o'clock until 7 o'clock when the mother worked. And then, unless you believe that the mother never slept, they didn't have child care in the house at that time, he took care of the child at that time. He is not in any way mentally incapacitated. As the record shows, he was an honor student in high school and post-high school training. He's a very bright person, an advocate for the disabled. Although he does use assistance, the testimony at trial is he can bathe himself, he can shower himself, he can do all of these things. It simply improves the quality of life. He can do it quicker, he can do it better, and he can do more things if he in fact does these things. Also, this is an unusual case because in the year before the final determination on physical custody was made, there was an arrangement in which they exchanged custody on a weekly basis. So not only was the child in the home every other week with Travis Arneson, but in those weeks in which he was, when she was in Travis Arneson's home, there is a daycare center in the home. And so in this case, he would have had her 24 hours a day and took care of the child. There was also testimony presented by, in addition to Travis Arneson's testimony, testimony presented by one of the assistants who had come in prior to the parties splitting up, knew Travis since he was 14 years of age, and said, he's the one who takes care of the child. That's all the testimony is. He is the one who takes care of the child. He can, in fact, bathe her. He can feed her. He can tend to her needs. And, in fact, the home study preparer says that he does a good job in responding to her needs. Cited examples both in her testimony and in the home study report. But at the end of the day, made some very discriminatory comments, especially in the case of nurturing. When discussing nurturing, she made the comment, well, it's easy for the child to get up into mom's lap and cuddle. It's not so easy to get into dad's lap. When asked if you're making that observation because of the wheelchair, she said, sure. Made presumptions, again. Presumptions based on fear that he can't respond to crisis situations. Absolutely ignores the fact that he's a counselor for 8 weeks in the summer at a camp for the disabled. He has training in CPR, he has ER training. This is exactly what the ADA is about. And we have state court, or we have state legislation also, that public entities, and others, you just can't make that presumption. You cannot, you have to look at the individual facts. We are not saying, and the Carney case is certainly not saying, that you can't look at the factor of physical health or mental health, but put it in its context. That's all we're asking, is put it in context. This court knows very well, whether you were on the trial bench or whether you were lawyers and sitting on this bench, you see cases before you on a regular basis of poor parenting. They usually are based on deficiencies of judgment, deficiencies of intellect, deficiencies in education, deficiencies in judgment. You simply do not see cases coming before you because of deficiencies in the ability to use one's limbs.
But aren't we really supposed to focus on the best interest of the child?
You are to focus on the best interest of the child. And if we look at the best interest of the child in this particular case, you have a father who has been involved from the get-go. This is not something where it's an unknown, can he function? He has functioned. Functioned alone in those time periods for the 5 months when this was a very young child. And again, if you believe that the mother didn't sleep, it would have been beyond the 8 hours that she was at work. Also, when you're looking at the factors, and this gets into the factors, if we don't even look at the ADA, if we don't even look at the repeal of the Tender Years Doctrine, if you look at the certain factors of stability, and if you look at the considerations here, how can you possibly say that it's more stable to take the child out of the home where the daycare is and go to another home? I mean, they keep saying that this was stable to have her sleep in the same home. You spend a lot of money. People, and this is just general knowledge, that you'll spend two, three, four times as much money to have your child in your home and have the daycare in the home so you have where the toys are, where the food is, where the playground equipment is, where the neighbors are. That is stability. That is what he has offered. Now, the situation also had come up, there was a fact, although the trial court did not say that it was parental misconduct. If you look at the findings of fact, conclusions of law, under the factor of parental misconduct, this is not applicable. There was an issue raised that they were not married. They were engaged at the time of trial. I have subsequently submitted a motion for the court to take judicial notice under the judicial notice statute and have provided you with the certificate of marriage. So that is not a factor of instability. And in fact, in this case, the what would be the stepmother now was the daycare provider. The home care or the home study preparer found that this person was did an excellent job, very good in her role, very good as a daycare provider. The letters that have been submitted to the trial court are consistent with that determination. On the other hand, when you look at stability and the situation that the mother is providing, we know that there have been at least two relationships, however you define the one relationship. She says it's a friend that this person was convicted of assaulting her. The second situation is an over-the-road truck driver, which she admits, stays in the home, and there were concerns about what influence the people she associates with have on this child. And in fact, the home study preparer has a recommendation that the mother receive counseling, individual counseling on her choice of personal relationships. So when you looked at that factor, what he has to provide is, again, somebody who's there. Although he does a lot of advocacy work on both the state and the national level, he is in the home. There are huge portions of time when he maybe not cannot provide that, but there are significant periods of time when he can give her more attention. Time, the ability to give time to the child is a consideration. Stability and continuity are considerations that should be looked into, and he is on top on that consideration. Also on the parenting test, although I'm not representing to the court that it was a huge difference, it's about a 7-point difference on the parenting test. I think the specific testimony, or at least in the report, is on 4 of 6 categories he exceeded the mother's skills in that category.
Excuse me, I'm going to interrupt you there. What we would have to do, though, what you're arguing here is, wouldn't the appellate court in this instance be substituting its judgment for the trial court, which you don't normally do?
No.
You would have to make a determination, as you suggest, that the findings were clearly erroneous. And how would we do that?
Well, there are some findings that are clearly erroneous. There very definitely are some findings that are clearly erroneous. I've cited to them specifically, and one is that the inability to share and inability to look at, to accommodate the mother. I will give the court the exact language that they used as far as not getting along and not sharing the child. There is absolutely no basis in the record for making that comment. In fact, the testimony at trial was that he was very respectful of the mother, that the parents worked well together. In fact, there simply is nothing. There's a transcript about this thick. I read it again last night. Is there one thing in there that indicates that he has in any way been obtrusive or has in any way interfered with the visitation of the mother? It just isn't there. The only thing that came up that even resembled that was the mother decided, contrary to the court's order, that he should let the child come home with her at night during the day when he has her in daycare. That wasn't the order of the court, and because of that, the mother took the child out of daycare for those weeks when the father had, you know, the alternating weeks when he had the child. So this is another piece of stability. The mother admits to switching daycare. She was asked if she switched daycare quite a bit. She said, I'm a single mother. I have to do what I have to do. But more closely related to your question, would you just have to disregard and make your own findings? No. I mean, first of all, the ADA is a piece of law. The case law before it made the same requirements as the ADA. The Tender Years Doctrine, you simply can't violate it. I believe it's Virginia and Connecticut.
But the Virginia findings really don't say that.
Yes,
using the Tender Years Doctrine.
If you say that you were relying on the conclusions and the recommendations of the preparer of the home study report, they do. And that testimony, when she said, to use a stereotypical example, she uses this term, stereotypical example, mothers are the more nurturing. So, yes, he relied on her, says it. In fact, when this first set of objections came in, and the objection was to the reliance on the home study preparer on both the discriminatory comments regarding the ADA and the blatant violation of the repeal of the Tender Years Doctrine, I thought, well, okay, now we're going to get the findings of fact and conclusion of law, and it will be distanced from that. It was not. It says that they find them persuasive and is relying heavily on them. So, again, although he didn't make a specific findings, he incorporated those of the home study preparer that is in the record. And again, you can still, under the established case law, require them to follow the principles. And if you're following stability, continuity, those factors here, when you look at what the mother's preparing as far as providing as far as daycare, what the mother is providing as far as people in the home, what the father can provide in terms of time and stability, if you look at those factors and don't rely on the factors that one should not be considering, this court is well within its power, is well within, is well justified in reversing this matter.
Now, what type of relief are you specifically seeking? Are you seeking a remand or an outright reversal?
Outright reversal.
All right.
I would prefer an outright reversal, always. But on those considerations, again, we don't even have to sit here, but we should. We should be looking at those considerations under the ADA. And we should not just look at that repeal of the tender years doctrine with a wink and a nod. And in addition to relying on the home study preparer, the court from the get-go made comments. He used tender years. He used the language. He said,
well,
no,
counsel, but comments. I mean, we ask comments every day, make comments and questions from the bench, and it's simply to probe the nature of the case. It doesn't mean that that's what the opinion of the court's going to be by any necessity.
But in this case, Your Honor, it is consistent. I understand that, because there are a lot of times you misspeak, the trial court misspeaks, the trial court says something, and you get something completely different in the findings of fact and conclusions of law. These do not deviate. They are not inconsistent with those comments. By relying on what the home study preparer gave in a testimony and in Exhibit 3, the home study report, which is consistent with those comments, one doesn't have to speculate as to whether the court simply disregarded the repeal of the tender years doctrine. Even the only person that's saying, I'm the primary caretaker, and that's kind of where the whole thing came up with, is a nurturing and primary caretaker, is the mother herself. And she herself, if you read her testimony, she's saying, well, you know, typically the mother is. No one can dispute that there's a very close bond between the father and the child. No one can dispute that he has taken care of her, has taken care of her alone, and makes every accommodation to his disability to take care of this child. All that's hanging out there is the unjustified fear. All that's hanging out there is that presumption that because this person has a disability which impacts the use of his limbs, has an impact on speech, but they found that they communicate very well together. That's what the court relied upon. The other factor that I would like the court to look at is how you treat the personal injury settlement, or the malpractice settlement in this case. And obviously the list in the statute is not exclusive. However, there are good reasons, and there is statutory basis, to not consider this as income to plug into the guidelines, but to use it as a basis to deviate. If the court were to do that, the court can recognize what we all know is true in these settlements, is that it doesn't all relate to lost wages or income. It can be permanent disability, pain and suffering. There are a number of things. And that's particularly true in his case. Well, the settlement agreement itself, Your Honor, is in evidence as Exhibit 4.
Does it break it down?
It doesn't really break it down. And in fact, I think it's paragraph 7. I believe it's paragraph 7, and it's in Exhibit 3. It's a payment both to his mother, father, and him to compensate for what has happened. That is the language in that.
Without the agreement actually specifying, how would the trial court be able to determine this?
You know, you don't. You never do. You never do unless maybe you've got a special verdict, I suppose, in the jury and actually went to trial. But even then, I mean, there are a number of things that aren't considered. You don't know how much of it goes to disability. You don't know if, even in a settlement, just how much money there was there. Okay, sometimes people are fully compensated. Sometimes it isn't going to cover even anything close to earned wages. This is something that happened to him when he was a baby.
So we would send it back on that issue. What we would What are you asking that we would direct the court to do?
To deviate from the guidelines and use the considerations which are critical. I mean, child support, it isn't just plug it in to see what the biggest number you can get. You look at the needs of the child and you look at the ability of the parent to pay. Doing what, and it's Louisiana court, I have two cases in there, outside court, that basically said do it that way, but it's Louisiana was very clear on that, bring it back in and look at those two considerations. Those are the valid considerations anyway.
Well, how many dollars of this monthly payment should be allocated to income and how much to the pain, suffering, settlement, and the other things that would not be considered income? What dollar figure are you suggesting?
Very, very difficult to do, so it's easier to say, what does the child need?
Did you put any evidence in or any expert testimony as to any allocation in the trial court?
Only the agreement. The settlement agreement is in there, and it doesn't have a breakdown. You couldn't do a breakdown.
Haven't you waived it then by not attacking that issue before?
It was attacked. And no, we haven't, because we're saying you didn't make an accommodation. Plus, you can tell this was done in, I believe, 1985. He's born in 1974. He's 11 years old. How do you make a determination on lost wages when someone's 11 years old? So, and it also compensates
both
parents.
Well, how do you do it now if we remand it to the trial court?
What you do is, what I'm saying is, you deviate. You don't consider it income, and you deviate and look only at the needs of the child and the ability of the parent to pay. Those are the two critical issues in any child support determination.
I thought your position at trial, though, was that none of that money should be considered whatsoever.
No.
That was not your position at trial?
That should not be considered as income for the guidelines.
But wasn't your position that the money couldn't be used, any of it could not be used for child support?
Pardon?
Wasn't your position at trial that money could not be used for child support?
No.
Was not income?
That is not my understanding of the record. We're saying it could not be considered, it should not be income under the guidelines.
All of it.
So what would you put in the income for the, how would you figure it?
You'd figure it like there isn't income, but it would be a huge deviation.
Okay. Well, your 25 minutes is up. You've got an extra 5 minutes with all the questions. Thank you, and you'll get 10 minutes later. Ms. Bird, you have 20 minutes.
Chief Justice, lady and gentlemen of the court, the Judge Zinner sitting at the end of this bench, it'd be some kind of idiot to stand up here and try to tell you that somebody can't be a real good dad because they sit in a wheelchair. Obviously, that's idiotic. It's in this day and age, it should be apparent on its face, and that isn't what Judge Zerska did in this case. Certainly, the cases, it seems like they've kind of abandoned their argument here regarding the applicability of the ADA. If you look at the reply affidavit, they acknowledge that there is no case that says you can't consider the impact of a disability on someone's ability to care for a child by virtue of the ADA. There simply is no such case because it doesn't do that. It needs to be considered. But as the case that was cited by Travis Arneson points out, the Carney case, it is a factor that can be considered, but it's normally a minor factor. And that is exactly and precisely what it was here. This case isn't about Travis and his disability. It's about Grace. Grace, at the time the case began, was 2 years old. She's now 4, and she will turn 5 this fall. And the real issue here is, was Judge Zerska clearly erroneous in his findings of fact and conclusions of law, not should the nod have been given to Mr. Arneson? You have to realize here that even the person doing the home study recognized in the end it was a close case. Her words were, but a decision has to be made. We have a little child who needs to be in a stable home, stable in the sense of where the child looks for nurturance, stable in the sense of where the child feels most closely bonded. That isn't to say that both of these parents aren't real good parents. They are. They each have merits, they each have demerits, But overall, they're both perfectly fine parents. Judge Sirska was left with the job of figuring out, overall, what was the best thing he could do for Grace. When you look at the findings of fact and the conclusions of law, there is no mention of his disability. The only way to say that it came into the case at all is by the judge's statement regarding his reliance on the expert testimony. But I think the court needs to see that in context. At the very beginning of the case, the judge actually made an opening statement. Neither counsel did. It was rather interesting if you read the judge's comments at the beginning of the case. What he does is go through Furstenberg. He made the opening statement to tell us what he wanted to hear about. And at the end, when he made findings, he went through Furstenberg, one thing at a time. He talked about fitness. Here he says, Teresa is fitter. Plaintiff is currently living with and having a sexual relationship with a woman to whom he is not married. More significantly, he has demonstrated great willingness to share the child with plaintiff, or excuse me, she has, whereas plaintiff tends to want to hang on to the child to meet his needs, rather than focusing on the needs of the child.
What evidence was there of that, to support that finding?
There was, if you look backwards in the file, in July, we have 2001, when this child was 2 years old, we had a hearing at that time regarding what should occur. And for him, the Judge Sirska, it was very unusual. He alternated custody on a weekly basis. And what happened during that time is they had difficulty about daycare. Now, during the week when Travis had the child was with him. He was living with a woman who was operating a daycare from his apartment. But during the week that she had the child, she was not comfortable with that, so she took the child to another daycare. Originally, they did the daycare together, and you'll find testimony about this at the trial. They did the daycare together. They went and agreed on a daycare provider, but that person became ill. And at that point, Travis wouldn't agree that she could get a different daycare provider and wouldn't help her with that. And for a year, a man who had $88,000 untaxed dollars a year coming in gave her $40 over the course of 13 months. That's why there's a child support arrearage in there of, I think, about $9,000. So she was left struggling with those kinds of issues because he wasn't concerned about good daycare for the child. He was concerned about getting his own way. That's what he was concerned about. Getting back to the findings of the court, where we get to any reference at all about Ms. Zimbelman's findings, the court says that at paragraph C, and there are two paragraphs in paragraph C, the court says, with regard to primary caretaker, this factor is of special significance here because, given the age of the child, I guess 10 years, the child's sense of security and safety, the child's sense of stability, come in large part through maintenance of her bond with a parent she regards as her primary caretaker. In this case, that has been mother until the separation of the parents when father became more active. In the next paragraph, the court says, also, the home study expert expressed the opinion that this child would do better with a primary home to anchor her. This seems of growing importance as this child is approaching school age. The expert also observed that the child looked slightly more to defendant, that would be Mrs. Arneson, for nurturance, and seemed slightly closer and more at ease with her. Her report notes the need for daily contact with her mother and to meet her needs. The last sentence at the end of the paragraph said, this court found the opinions and observations of the expert to be reasonable and well-grounded and has placed great weight upon them. When you look at what the expert actually said, she found them both to be suitable parents. But she said, a decision has to be made. This little girl, she was three at that time, needs an anchor. Her stability requires that she needs an anchor. The main reason here isn't his disability. It's the fact that she's a little closer to her father, to her mother, than she is to her father, that she seems to look a little more at mother for nurturance, and that it appeared to the court that mother had been the primary caretaker.
What about the wheelchair comments that counsel had argued? There was some testimony, or the home study person.
She did. She did, and what she actually said, and it was in her report too. It was in her report as well. Of course, I'm not going to flip right to it. The question was asked, did you have a chance to observe Mr. Arneson actually care for this child? Did you not? She answered, yes. Did you observe that there in fact were limitations? And this is on page 20 of the transcript. And she says, I think to be realistic, there are limitations. That doesn't necessarily mean it's a detriment. It's factual. He has some limitations. He does an extraordinary job handling his limitations and with parenting the child. However, Edith, his girlfriend that lives there, is not the parent, and we are looking at deciding custody between the two parents. Edith does a great job, too. I think from observing running the daycare, she does an excellent job running the daycare. She is there and available to help Travis, and she can help also with the child, but she's not the child's mother. And she went through discussing what his abilities are. And he had the ability to do most of the things that you require. Her only reservation would be, could he act with sufficient speed and strength in an emergency situation? And it was a minor concern. The main thing was not his disability. The entire cross-examination centers on his disability, but that isn't what the report centered on, and it isn't what the decision centered on. When she gets to looking at, it's obvious she sees her as the nurturing person in her life, referring to Mrs. Arneson. She is also comfortable with that. It's not as easy to run over and jump into his lap. But she's 2 years old. She doesn't analyze whether someone is able to hold her well or not. She looks to who actually does provide her care. Physically, that's been her mother throughout most of her lifetime, or someone else acting on behalf of father to a considerable extent. I don't see that as a big issue here. This is not a bad dad, a disabled dad not able to care for the child. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about whether, on balance, one parent gets the nod. And in fact, when you read the closing comments that Judge Sirska made, he made oral findings, that's what he says as he goes through the Furstenberg factors. He calls it a nod. And that's what it was. There wasn't some big clear winner here. Mother got the nod. In a close case, it seems to me the real issue is, are the findings reasonably supported by the evidence? And they are, especially as to those things that are most essential. And the real issue there is in subpoint C. He only made findings on fitness, stability, and primary caretaker. And when you read them, it's pretty obvious what was really important. When you look, when we talk about primary caretaker and the bond of the child, that takes up 2/3 of the page. And about 1/3 is to the other two factors. So the real emphasis here was on the child's closest bond and maintaining her sense of security and well-being by maintaining that closer bond. With regard to the tender years doctrine, the tender years doctrine simply refers to a law that gave a woman a preference with little kids. It's the tender years. The use of the phrase hasn't been barred. the use of the doctrine has been barred, and Judge Sirska, not a kid, says, at the very beginning of the case, at page 14 of the transcript, one parent may be more suitable when the child is of tender years than when the child becomes of school age. He didn't say, mother may be more suitable when the child is of tender years. He was talking about the age needs of the child. This court recognizes that children of different ages have different needs, and that little children's needs are substantially different than older children's needs. And in this court's visitation guidelines, and in the Furstenberg case, the court was real specific in noting that as to little children, children of tender years, the need there is frequently to recognize the importance of the bond between usually a primary caretaker and the nurturance that the child gets from that, the sense of stability that the child draws from that parent.
So have this child been 50-50 with both parents up to this point?
Yes. It had been from July when the divorce started.
And this was, how many months then?
About a year. It was about a year later. The child had been 50-50. Obviously, that's the most obvious thing here. If the judge had been all concerned about his physical ability to care for the child, indeed, if mother had been all concerned, that child wouldn't have been 50% of the time in the care of the father. That's the plain fact in there. From the get-go, the court was not looking at his disability. It was looking at his ability and recognized that these parties were about even up. So the job of the court here is to decide whether the trial court clearly abused its discretion. And I just can't see how it is clearly erroneous. The fact that the expert gave some consideration to it falls within the rule of Carney, which was cited by Mr. Arneson, saying that, of course, you have to look at those things. But I don't think, this is one of those cases where it's pretty easy to get lost looking at the trees rather than seeing the forest. The reality is Mr. Arneson's abilities as a parent have been recognized. He had the child 50% of the time. He still has the child, or is allowed to have the child on virtually a daily basis if he wants to be there while daycare is occurring, and if mother continues to use the daycare. The reality is that nobody is excited about his so-called disability. The only issue arose at the very outset as a safety issue, not in terms of daily care. And that issue gets fainter and fainter and fainter as the child gets older and older and older and more able to consider her own safety. And it wasn't a factor at all in the decision-making of the court, or he wouldn't have had the child 50% of the time. And it wasn't a factor in the decision of the court at trial, because there's not a word about it in his findings. The only reference he makes to a person who did consider it, the home study person, is at the end of a paragraph which deals primarily with the nurturance and bonding issues. That's it. I think it's important to take a look at what may be at the heart of the case, or at least partially at the heart of the case. Remember, I told you a few minutes ago that $40 had been provided as assistance from a man who had $88,000 a year to a woman who was making $22,000 a year over approximately a little better than a year's time, and it resulted in a large arrearage being awarded against him at the time of trial.
Was there an order that ordered him to pay more than that?
I'm sorry?
Was there an order that ordered him to pay more than that? That he
there was no order because the court assumed there would be a 50-50 care there. I don't think that was appropriate that the court did it, but I don't usually approve appeal interim support order because of the disparity in the earnings. But take a look at why the court didn't look at the disparity in earnings. Mr. Arneson lied, L-I-E-D, to the court. If you read his affidavit when the case started, he said that money wasn't his money, that it was his mother's money, and that his mother very graciously permitted him to have it because he needed it. Well, when we actually get the agreement, it turns out that she was a guardian ad litem. The money was awarded when he was a child, and of course, when he turned 18, it was his money, right? He wants to say to you now, in what shall we say, a little word game there. Well, no, we didn't want to exclude all of that money from consideration for child support. We just didn't want to include it as income. What is the difference there? If it's not included as income to calculate child support, I guess we've excluded it then.
Well, Ms. Byrd, it seems like most of the cases that I've read allocate some portion of these types of awards to the income, to income, to the extent that they are, and don't count, you know, other aspects of a settlement that may relate to the injury or compensation for medicals or whatever it might be. What is the status of the record as far as what was asked of Judge Sirska? What proof was offered on the allocation and that type of thing? Or was this simply an all or nothing request?
At the time of the trial, looking back at what the court actually did, the court excluded $16,000 of the income. And it did that based on records I put into evidence. Apparently, there wasn't going to be any evidence at trial. They were making some claims, as I recall, at trial regarding how much extra help he needed, expensive help, because of his disability. And he had provided ledgers for, I think, about 7 months of the years that showed his expenses. And it was from those ledgers that I put into evidence that the court extrapolated he had about $16,000 a year in extraordinary expenses related to his illness. The only other item placed into evidence on that, again, I placed it into evidence, was exhibit number, I think it's 3, and that is the original agreement. It's titled, it's number 4, excuse me, Arneson Release and Settlement Agreement. And it doesn't make any kind of an allocation. So I guess the answer to your question is the defense didn't choose to present any information about how it ought to be allocated. And in fact, any real information about it at all was presented by the other side, because he had been claiming that it wasn't his money, that it was his mother's money. And in fact, the court did find that he had been rather coercive in trying to use the financial issue to manipulate the settlement. Note also that
your time has expired, counsel. Thank you.
Thank you.
You didn't get to barrage your questions at the end that your opponent did. So mm-hmm. You're held to 20 minutes.
I'm always mistreated.
Ms. Allen, you have 10 minutes.
First of all, with regard to the question of whether or not disability was a factor, I would direct the court's attention to page 25 of the trial transcript of July 10th, 2002. Question being asked on line 5 of page 25. Do you think it's fair to say your recommendation on both parties is because of the fact that they are in a wheelchair and there is, what you appear to have in your mind and society does, a disability? And a response from the home study preparer, upon which the trial court based great reliance, is, I don't think it's necessarily just a wheelchair. I think it's ability to respond quickly to crisis situations. There is no question, when asked, is this the basis of your recommendation? She said, it is A, the wheelchair, and B, this ability to respond quickly to a crisis, which she just presumes. She says, I don't know, but I think he couldn't. Not only that, to say that the trial court was not concerned about this, or that counsel, or the appellee was not concerned about it, is simply revisionist history. It ignores everything that is right in the transcript. At the July 2001 hearing,
Appellee's counsel says. So frankly, our concern here isn't his good intentions or his desire and knowledge of appropriate care for the child. It is his physical disability to do that. That is motion transcript, page 3. I think it's either page 7 or 11 on the other transcript. She says right off the bat, we have two concerns. One is stability, and two is disability. Counsel has said, well, if the trial court had any concern about the disability, would have done this 50-50 thing. At that motion hearing in 2001, the court says, and again, this is motion transcript, page 10, you know, obviously he is handicapped, so I don't know, you know, without hearing some testimony that he can't take care of the child. Again, then even after there was a determination to make that 50-50 split, he says, the defendant, though, better make sure they can take care of her. Motion transcript, page 11. The report and the testimony says that throughout the report, we observed the issue of his disability. I mean, this isn't something we're just coming up here and saying that it was a wink and a nod, but we know that we're looking at that. They're very blatant in saying this is what they're looking at. Asked directly to say this is what we're looking at. When Ms. Burge comes up and says, this is what we're concerned about, she says, disability. And now it's like, oh no, this had nothing to do with it. Had a lot to do with it. And if you want to look at the other factors just simply out there. Primary caretaker, your home study preparer wouldn't even say the mother was the primary caretaker. There's only one person who says she's the primary caretaker, and that is the mother.
Counsel, your opponent has said that the case here was a real close one that tipped ever so slightly in favor of her client. Obviously, you don't think it tipped in favor of her client, but do you see it as close?
Don't even see it as close.
It's a blowout.
Pardon? It isn't close. It isn't close. When you're looking at inspectors, who took care of the kid? Who's got a daycare center in his home where the kid has the stability? This isn't even close. Who's got a person that the home study preparer actually interviewed, spent some time, so this person is excellent. This bird stood up here and read what the home study preparer wrote. Was wonderful about Edith, who is now his wife. That's stability. He's got to
explain away or justify the payment of only $40 a month to this mother for this child over a period of a year, if that's the fact.
I can do that very, very easily. Why that happened is the child was supposed to be in one daycare center. If you want to look at stability, you keep your kid in one daycare. Her client, and if you look at the testimony at trial, she admits it. She wanted to take the child home during Travis's week. And even though that's not what the order says, and when she couldn't, she got mad and put the kid in another daycare during her weeks, okay? So when she had the week, instead of keeping it in a stable daycare, she brings it home to her and then wants them to pay for it. Now, he was upset, and if you look at the daycare situation, there's a testimony in the trial transcript. She admits she changed it all the time, and the one where Travis didn't want the child there, he'd gone there to pick up the child, and the person who's supposed to provide it isn't there and somebody else is there. So they actually came to an agreement, this isn't a good place, and they changed it. But the $40, Ms. Bird has some problem with it. Then you go back in the trial court, tell the trial court, well, my client doesn't want the child there all the time because she doesn't think it's fair that she can't bring her home every night. And then go back and see if the trial court orders something. He gave her more than he was ordered to give her, and he gave her money under circumstances he should not have given her. You talk about an anchor, that you need an anchor. This is your anchor. You've got two parents. You don't have somebody like she's got that the home study preparer says, yeah, I didn't interview him. You know, I'm going to recommend, because we've got these concerns here, that she has people who aren't good in it. There were concerns outside of Travis's that were presented to her, that this woman has something to do with people that she shouldn't, aren't good for the child. She doesn't even interview him. She knows something like the mother said, well, she'll keep him away from him. I mean, when you put things in perspective, really, what is this court seeing? What is your experience? What is common sense here? Is the concern that physically disabled people are always running into these crisis situations and they can't respond to them, especially someone who works 8 weeks a year every summer as a counselor at a camp for the disabled. He has a record here. This is not an unknown. He had that child more than she did. How you can call her the primary caretaker, I have simply no idea. She simply did not take care of the child as much as he did. And even right now, she is not in a situation to take care of that child and attend to that child's needs on the regular basis that Mr. Arneson is. But what is the concern? That somehow physically disabled people don't understand crisis or emergency situations? Or you've got somebody who's your second, at least your second, what appears to be a lover. The first one's convicted of assaulting you. And you say, well, yeah, I've got to, you know, okay, we've ordered her to go get some counseling on her personal relationships, and she might not keep him around. Some unknown person who isn't even in the capacity of a stepfather is more of a concern to that child. Ms. Bird said, well, let's look at Grace. I'm saying look at Grace, too. Look at Grace. And this child would have a better life if she can get up in the morning, be in the daycare with the kids that are there, be in her neighborhood, stay in that home, be fed in that home, have toys in that home, have the toys in the backyard, have two parents that a home study preparer has looked at and said are very fit, qualified people to take care of her, or have a situation that we do have now.
Now, the judge didn't order any counseling for her, did he?
No, it's in the home study report.
The home study, okay.
It is in the home study report. And again, when you look at the release and settlement agreement, not as Exhibit 4 to the trial transcript, and he didn't LIED. When you look at the, he fully disclosed that she gives him the money, the mother gives the money, but it's paragraph 7 and again paragraph 3 that the payment was in fact made to his parents, or paragraph 2. They pay to Marcia and Lonnie, and it was this is 3% escalation factor, and it is compounded annually. And again, this whole thing was made when he was 11 years old. That is why the Louisiana court, when you say let's look at it to deviate, makes some sense. When you get a settlement when a kid's 11 years old, it is pretty hard to predict how much of this money goes to lost wages. If you become disabled during your adult life or even close to your adult life and you can predict what you would have made but for that disability, you might be able to factor that out. In this case, it's pretty hard to do this. It was made when this child was 11, and it was also, if you look on paragraph 7 of the release and settlement agreement,
are you saying that we should deviate in the sense that we should call it instead of income an asset and then use it as that way? Because I know there's
yes.
a specific statute that says an asset can be used to deviate.
Yes. That would make a whole lot more sense. I mean, in any situation, again, unless you have that special verdict that says so much of this goes to your lost wages, or if the parties actually did that, or there's something in the record to say this is what these people, or this is what this person made, then he became disabled, and this is what we need to restore him on the issue of lost wages, then you can say, we'll pull this out, and this is going to be income. And for purposes of income tax, you can take it out and say that this is income. You just can't do this with what we've got here. You've got a child that the oxygen was cut off somewhere like the first 24 hours after he was born. And again, you've got a physical disability. He is a bright, articulate, by if you read any of the letters in the file, if you read all of the testimony, this is an extraordinary person. This is somebody who gets along with people, very bright, articulate advocate, has been an honor student, has many skills, many fine qualities. But again, at this time, you simply are not in a situation with him where I can look at, or anyone can look at this and say how much of it even went to him.
Your time has expired, counsel. Thank you. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.